Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm journalist Jonathan Curiel, and I'll be your moderator for today's program called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Michael David Lucas. Michael is an Oakland writer whose new novel is The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. His previous work, The Oracle of Stamboul, has been translated into more than a dozen languages. Michael David Lucas was a Fulbright scholar in Turkey and also studied at the American University of Cairo. He was educated at Brown University and has an MFA from the University of Maryland. He studied and lived around the world, and it's our extreme pleasure to welcome Michael David Lucas.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Celia. Where'd you go? Oh, there. It's a real pleasure to be here. I have to say I was a bit dismayed when I walked in and saw my face right next to Sebastian Gorka's. You know, if you're not familiar with him, someone with, you know, ties to Hungarian fascists and, you know, a pretty widely accepted Islamophobe who's a sort of faux academic kicked out of the Trump administration for his defense of white nationalists before and after Charlottesville. So, you know, but then I was thinking, gosh, should I even do this event? Like, this is what, am I like, you know, throwing my lot in with Sebastian Gorka? You know, and as I talked with Cecilia, you know, it's important to, hear a wide range of voices on every topic, but you know, to me, there's certain voices that, we shouldn't give a platform to necessarily. So that's my perspective. Because in giving the platform to him, we're amplifying them. But then I was like, oh, you know what? Basically, my book is the exact opposite of Sebastian Gorka. Like, what I set out to do in this book is to, you know, counter that Islamophobia, to counter that sort of ethno-nationalist impulse, and to, you know, highlight and give a platform to a story that I think is not told very often about coexistence, and specifically Jewish-Muslim coexistence. I'll say just a little bit about the sort of genesis of the book, since I'm sort of giving a little preamble anyways, and then I'll read a little bit. But the idea for this book came to me when I was living in Cairo about 20 years ago, in the year 2000, right during the Intifada, and I was studying abroad there, and really fell in love with the city, but had a hard time squaring my sort of infatuation with Cairo with my own American Jewish identity. And it felt like, how can I be, you know, an American Jew in the midst of the Second Intifada and be also someone who loves Cairo and feels connected to Cairo? And then I sort of stumbled upon the Ibn Ezra Synagogue, which this book revolves around, which is a 1,000-year-old synagogue, almost 1,000-year-old synagogue in the heart of Cairo. And I realized, oh, these things are not mutually exclusive. You know, in fact, there's this long and really beautiful history of coexistence between Jews and Muslims, you know, for much of that 1,000 years. Of course, you know, as we know and as we saw in the video, there's also, you know, also a history of discrimination expulsion, which is, I think, also important to talk about, and I do in the book. Anywho, that's the sort of seed of the book, but I think it's always best to just dive right in. So I will read the opening couple pages, and then I thought we could talk, me and Jonathan could talk a bit, and then we'll open it up to questions. A long, long time ago, before Mubarak and the revolution, before Sadat and Begin, before Nasser, the free officers in the Suez crisis, before the Suez Canal, before Herzl, before Dreyfus, before Solomon Schechter in the Cambridge University Library, before Ismail Pasha and Muhammad Ali Pasha, before the British, the French, the Ottomans, the Mamluks, and the Ayyubids, before the Great Plague and Saladin, before Maimonides, the great sage, may his memory be for a blessing. Our story begins before all this, in the reign of El-Mustansir, when Cairo was still two cities and the Jews but a tribe among them. It was late summer in the 4800th year of creation, 4 centuries after Muhammad's migration to Medina, and more than 1,000 years after the birth of Jesus. The Nile had crested a few days earlier, and its entire shallow valley shone with damp brilliance. Beneath the purple silhouetted swoop of storks, the clang of an eager blacksmith mingled with the call to prayer and the smell of baking bread. That particular morning, there was another smell, too, something sharp and unfamiliar at first. No one could put a name to it until, bleary-eyed and still warm from bed, they stepped out into the day and saw that neat black thread of smoke rising from the Ibn Ezra synagogue. Before long, a crowd gathered in the courtyard of the synagogue, women and children, dyers and glassblowers, pharmacists, money changers, and fishermen. For most, this was their first glimpse of the newly reconstructed synagogue, still unfinished, still unconsecrated by prayer, and already this beautiful new building was blackened by fire. It was a terrible thing, and yet it could have been worse. Apart from the smell of smoke in the prayer hall, the damage was limited to a shadow of soot beneath the scaffolding where the fire had started. Who would do such a thing? Some more hopeful members of the crowd thought they saw signs of an accident, a stray coal or a clumsy housewife. Others insisted that the fire would turn out to be the work of petty vandals. And then there were those who regarded it as something more sinister, a reminder and portent of things to come. Not that anyone needed reminding. Who could forget the reign of El-Hakim the Horrible? Who did not shiver to think of that sister-loving, false prophet who had destroyed nearly a dozen synagogues and churches, including the original Ibn Ezra? Who could forget that hateful despot who had gone so far as to outlaw malachia, the leafy green vegetable also known as Jew's mallow? He was gone now, El-Hakim, dead for nearly 20 years, and the current caliph, El-Mustansir, had proven himself to be a friend of the Jews. Still, one never knew. This discussion about the cause of the fire went on for some time, and all the while, Ali ibn al-Marwani was standing at the edge of the courtyard, waiting for the right moment to step forward. Fingering the sleeve of his robe, he tried to recall what he had been told to say, whom he was supposed to seek out. But in the effort to remember the directions to the synagogue, he had forgotten what he was supposed to do when he got there. Eventually, as the crowd was beginning to disperse, someone noticed him. All at once, he felt the balance of attention shift. They were talking about him, an unfamiliar boy, thin cotton robe and cheap sandals, no older than 13. And as the murmur of insinuation collected to a boil, a circle formed around him. For a moment, Ali was alone in the middle of the courtyard. Then a young man stepped forward and grabbed him by the scruff of his robe. "Did you do this?" the young man demanded, forcing Ali's gaze toward the remnants of the fire. Ali opened his mouth, but he was not able to speak. "It is said that a thief returns to the scene of his crime," the young man continued. "Could not the same be said for our arsonist?" There was a buzz of agreement, followed by a few muttered calls for revenge. Why does he not respond? Why did he not announce himself? What is his business with us? The young man paused and looked out over the crowd as if expecting an answer. Instead, the silence was punctured by the sound of an old man clearing his throat. "Shamaria the Pious," someone said, and everyone stepped aside, making way for a hunched man with a mane of white hair tangled in his beard. When he got to the center of the circle, he addressed himself to the young man, who was still holding Ali by the scruff of his robe. "Amram," he said, "is it not written that we should judge everyone from his most favorable side? Yes, Father, but would you release him? Shamari the pious said. Then he turned to Ali. He did not smile, but his eyes crinkled with compassion. Tell us your business here, my child. There was a long silence before Ali could bring himself to speak. I have a message from Abu Saad, he said finally. The crowd grew ever more silent as Ali produced a note from the sleeve of his galabeya. Abu Saad was chief advisor to the caliph and the Jews' most important ally inside the palace. Correspondence from him was always important, but on this day of uncertainty, the Jews of Fustat were particularly eager for his reassurance. You're not Abu Saad's usual messenger, Shamaria the pious observed. What is your name? Ali ibn al-Marwani. You are Muslim? Ali nodded. And your father's profession? He was a water carrier, but he died before I was born. I live with my mother's brother near Babzuela. May God protect the orphans, Shamaria the pious said, and a murmur of assent rippled through the crowd. Once Ali's business, name, faith, and patrimony were established, Shamaria the pious unfolded Abu Saad's note and read through it twice. He closed his eyes for a moment to think, then he pulled a reed pen from his pocket, requested a bit of ink, and composed a reply on the reverse. This is for Abu Saad, he said, handing the note back to Ali. You must not give it to anyone else. Do you understand? Yes, Ali said, and he returned the note to the folds of his sleeve. Shamaria the pious concluded the exchange by addressing himself to the assembled crowd, though his words were clearly intended for his son Amram. We should not stoop to unfounded accusations, especially not today. There's too much work to be done. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you for reading that.
My pleasure.
One of the questions I want to ask you, you set up the book in a way where it's a Muslim, a young Muslim working mm-hmm. at a synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of set up for tension and so forth, for getting along, for theorizing about how they get along. But one of the main characters in your book, Joseph,
mm-hmm.
Has a Muslim father and a Jewish mother.
Yeah.
So you have, not only do you set up the tension through these other characters, but there's somebody who's actually embodying the tension within one person.
Yeah.
You don't often see that in novels, but it's in yours. Can you talk about going to that extent to doing this, this embracing the tension and basing the idea of compatibility?
Yeah. I mean, Yusuf was always had, one Muslim parent and one Jewish parent. In my mind, and I can see how he becomes a metaphor for sort of coexistence because two different religions are coexisting inside him. And so the issue was sort of how to treat him in a way that was true to him as a character and didn't just make him a symbol. You know what I mean? But I've always been sort of obsessed with the idea that you can technically be both Jewish and Muslim at the same time, because Jews have matrilineal descent and Muslims have patrilineal descent. I guess if you to become a Muslim, you have to say the Shahada. And, if you say that, maybe that sort of cancels out your Judaism. So maybe you can't actually be both at the same time. But I did like the idea that, you could have both of these things sort of coexisting within you in a way that was sort of sanctioned by both communities. I think that... And then the other thing is that he's the product of, a union between a young Jewish woman from Cairo and one of the watchmen of the synagogue, a young Muslim man. And so then there's that whole story there, that love story between his parents. And it didn't work out, but I think it's still kind of an interesting story, or at least to me.
And one of the things that comes through in the book is it's an historical novel that also traces back to the present day. And it's also about Muslim-Jewish relations, but it's also about the quest for love and desire and things you can have or cannot have.
Mm-hmm.
And you really weave that in through the book. And I'm not going to give away the entire plot. Hopefully a lot of you in the audience will buy the book or read it. But there is a lot. You do weave in not just religion, but love.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of forbidden love, in a sense. Can you talk about having to do that?
Well, that was... Once I kind of had Joseph as a character, which was very early on, and recognized that, you know, he was the union of, you know, this sort of forbidden relationship. And also Joseph very early on, you know, came to me as a character as gay. And so I wanted to explore the sort of relationships that he had when he was in Cairo. And those are obviously, you know, forbidden for other reasons. And so then, you know, then I was like, oh, it's sort of something you do when you're writing, or at least I do when I'm writing. Maybe it's not the most efficient thing, but it's like you write a draft and you're like, oh, there's some like connections going on here. There's some sort of themes. Like, why don't I amplify them a little bit? And so then I was like, oh, let me bring in a little more forbidden love here and there. And that's not like, you know, the most sort of muse-worthy sort of answer. But, you know, sometimes as writers, we have to balance the muse with our sort of craftsmanship and our you know, getting our... getting sweaty and sort of, you know, sanding down the parts that don't work and, you know, gluing together the parts that do.
Well, speaking of which, this book took you 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's
a lot of sanding,
a lot of
gluing.
A lot of sanding. Now, for people who write novels, I think it's about an average amount of time. For people who don't write novels, they think, why did it take so long? So the question is, why did it take either so long or the perfect amount of time, or, you know, what were sort of the dips and highs and stops and starts?
Yeah, my first book took, I'm trying to answer this question without getting too into the weeds, but my first book took 8 years. And what I always said about that was I was learning to write a novel at the same time that I was writing a novel. Which is sort of like learning to fly a plane at the same time that you're flying a plane. Like, you know, it's really easy to have a crash landing. Luckily, when you're writing a novel, you know, no one gets hurt when you have a crash landing. But with the second book, I didn't really have that excuse. But I think that what was going on for me with the second book, sort of looking back over the process, is it was a typical sort of sophomore situation where I would, you know, I was a wise fool. Which is what the word sophomore means. I kind of thought I knew some things that I didn't know, and I, you know, knew some things that I thought I didn't know. And so it was really the process of kind of being aware of like what I was overly confident of, and also being aware of what I was sort of like overly hard on myself about, that ended up taking many years, like, you know, finishing a draft and thinking I was done. And then, you know, sending it to my agent, she's like, it's not done, or you need, you know, maybe think about this, and then sort of coming back to it with those fresh eyes. And then there's, you know, just life that happens in between. I was lucky enough to not have to work another job for most of the time that I was writing this book. But then I started having to, and then when my daughter was born, I was like, oh gosh, like, you know, I want to get some health insurance and, you know, maybe start a retirement account, and some life insurance and all these things that I had not thought of before. And so, I basically had a part-time job that paid for all those sort of responsible adult things. And yeah, so that was the last year or two. So I'll chalk that up to that as well.
We'd like to remind our listening and internet audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. And we're speaking with Michael David Lucas. Speaking of the novel as a work in progress and then finally getting done, I read that the book's original title was The 43rd Name of God, which referenced Joseph's last name, Al-Raqba, which is Arabic for the watcher, and one of the 99 names of God. did you have to negotiate with the publisher? No, I insist on this name. And they said, no, we insist on this name. If you want to get a movie out of this, you better go with this.
I did. Yeah, it was, I mean, I have made my peace with this title, as you should when, you know, you're going around talking about a book with the title on it. You know, you have to make your peace with it. But that 43rd Name of God is still close to my heart. And yeah, there was a lot of back and forth with the publisher. I think the core sort of issue is that to an author, the title is this sort of like integral part of the artistic product. And to a publisher, the title is, you know, a key marketing tool. And, you know, so those things were like not really matching up. But I did do some semi-scientific research around these two titles. My brother is a public health PhD, and so he's very into like statistics and stuff like that. And so he set up this, you know, like I said, semi-scientific poll of friends of friends, and they actually came out perfectly tied with each other. And so seeing those results, seeing the data, made me feel like, okay, I can just let this go. Because it's the type of thing where, like, A, you don't want to be the guy who everyone is, like, talking about around the water cooler, being like, oh, this author is being such a pain in the neck. But you, and you know, I feel like what my agent said is you have, like, one thing you can really fight. And so she was like, is this the thing that you want? This the hill that you want to die on? And eventually, at first I thought it was, but then eventually I came to realize that it wasn't.
Well, I think all of us are glad that wasn't anything that delayed the book. So thank you for giving in, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. But I like to talk about the alternate title at every event, just so that, you know, just to still put it out there.
One of the questions from the audience is what inspired the storyline? And I know it's a complicated answer. And I know part of it has to do, as a lot of people's answers often are, with being on a plane, having to sit next to someone and suddenly realize, oh, wow, that's the coolest thing ever. Can you talk about
how... do other people have that answer?
Well, a lot of people, a lot of people's stories begins with, oh, it's happened on a plane.
Huh.
So
well,
your story...
So I had gotten the original seed for the book when I was in Cairo, when I was studying abroad there. And then I came home back to my senior year of college and started trying to write this book. And it was like this one of these thinly veiled Romana Clefs about, you know, an American Jew who studies abroad in Cairo and has some sort of semi-interesting experiences. And as a, you know, it was my senior thesis for, you know, creative writing. And so it served its purpose. But I soon sort of realized that maybe this isn't the book I want to write. And maybe I'm not ready to write this book. So I set it aside and wrote what later became my first book. And so 8 years later, when that first book was being finished, and I was just starting to think about what I was going to work on next, I got on a plane. I forget exactly. I think I was going to New York, but it was a cross-country flight. And I got on, and I see this distinguished South Asian woman sitting in the seat next to my seat. And I always think of, you know, there's two different types of people on airplanes. Those who want to chat, and those who don't want to chat. And I fall in the don't want to chat category, but she was like firmly in the want to chat category. And she wanted to chat the whole flight. And that was, you know, I was a little bit frustrated about that at first. But then eventually, you know, she had a really amazing story. She moved from Calcutta to Madison, Wisconsin, as a young woman in the 60s. And talked a lot about that, and she also told me this sort of key piece of information about her distant cousin, who is a watchman of the synagogue in Calcutta, a Bengali Muslim guy who, you know, had it sort of inherited it from his father. And as soon as she said that, the sort of all the pieces of this Cairo novel fell together, and I realized, you know, it's not just a novel about this young man going to Cairo and sort of discovering himself. It's a novel about, you know, this long history and this history of coexistence. And what better to embody this history of coexistence than, you know, a young Muslim man watching over a synagogue. And then so I started writing the book, and you know, partway through the process, became concerned that I was like creating this history out of whole cloth, and that it wasn't true to life. But then did some research and found out that there is actually a tradition of Muslims watching over synagogues beyond just in Calcutta. In Morocco, there's a lot of Muslim watchmen of synagogues and also graveyards in Libya and elsewhere in North Africa. As far as I know, there was not any Muslim watchman of this particular synagogue, Ibn Ezra, but 1,000 years is a long time. So who knows? Maybe there was. So I am very glad that I sat next to that woman and that I, you know, didn't just put my headphones on as soon as she started talking.
Yeah, I think it's called serendipity.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Well, you sort of answered this question, but there's a question from the audience about how much of the book is factual. The first part of the question is there any relationship or connection to the two Muslim keyholders to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem? And I think one of the a broader question is how much pressure did you feel to write an historical novel that really gets into the nitty gritty? Mm-hmm. And that also, but then also goes back to being a great story that could entertain people and, you know, not have to adhere to rigid history.
Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of big question that I've been thinking about a lot over the past 15 or so years, writing two historical novels. With my first book, I was a little more fast and loose, one might say, with the historical facts. Not through disregard for history, but, you know, my thinking was, first of all, that the first book is a kind of fantastical novel, right? It's kind of fabulous. So my thinking was, A, this is a work of fiction. It's not necessarily supposed to be true. B, it's about this sort of like preternaturally intelligent girl who's followed around by a flock of hoopoes. So like anyone who thinks this is real, like, I don't know. Like, I think there's a lot, or not to denigrate readers, but like maybe a better way to say it is like, you know, there's a lot of signs that this is not a wholly factual book. And so I felt fine playing with the history. I moved, you know, a palace from one place to another for like, so I could get a better view that I could describe, you know, things like that. And I represented one of the biggest things I think is I represented the Sultan who's in the book, Abdulhamid II, who some of you may be familiar with. He's sort of a key figure in Middle Eastern history as this kind of bumbling despot, right? Who's in over his head, sort of a Henry V or IV, George Bush type figure. What's his name? The Habsburg Emperor. Anyways, so I sort of made him a little less, a little more bumbling, and a little less kind of despotic. Because it fit with my novel. And then when the novel came out, I got a letter from one of my former professors, who is an expert in Ottoman history, and who wrote a book about Abdulhamid II and was actually thrown in jail in Turkey for his sort of history of Abdulhamid II, because he's a very controversial figure. He's a sort of semi-modernizer. Some people see him as kind of anti-Islam or anti sort of, you know, Muslim Brotherhood-y Islam. And also, you know, kind of was instrumental in perpetrating the Armenian genocide. So very controversial for a number of different reasons. And he wrote me, the professor wrote me, and said, you know, I love the book, but I wonder why you don't feel like you have to adhere to these, like, widely accepted historical sort of facts. And he said it in a very sort of gentle way. But it really got me thinking, you know, and the combination of that and going to a lot of different book groups and speaking at a lot of different events where it became clear to me that people were taking it at face value. And that this was their only experience of late Ottoman history. And this is coloring their sort of view of this time period, really made me sort of do a 180 on the question. And so with this book, although I did, you know, invent this Al-Rakab family, I tried very hard to sort of stick to the historical facts. Luckily, there is a 6-volume book called A Mediterranean Society about the Jews of Cairo in the 11th century. And the other plot line, the historical plot line that I write, is about the Agnes and Margaret Lewis and Smith, who go to Cairo and sort of discover or slash steal this cache of documents in the Ibn Ezra synagogue. And that is completely based on the historical record. And I think most importantly, I'm clear in this little afterword that I write about what's true and what's not true and what's based on fact and what isn't. And to me, writing a historical novel is really summed up in this quote that I put at the end of the author's note, which I'll read aloud, by the poet Edmund Jabes, who is himself an Egyptian Jew. The writer, like the historian, lends a meaning to the past, but contrary to the latter, he destroys the past by giving it form. And so to me, it's like, you know, this awesome responsibility of writing about the past. Because, you know, there may be scholars who read this book who know about 11th century Cairo, who know about Agnes and Margaret. But there's also going to be a lot of people who don't. And so I want to, you know, push back against that sort of like post-fact world that we're living in. which is the other sort of thing that happened, you know, in recent years that made me feel that it is really important to stick to the historical facts, such that we know them.
Pause to let that sink in. And it's also a time to remind our listening and internet audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. We're talking to writer and novelist Michael David Lucas. Let me continue with the theme, that theme of reframing history. One of the people in your book, and he's not a main character, but he's a reference definitely, and he actually opens the book, is Maimonides, the great 12th and 13th century physician and scholar who was essentially expelled from Spain and ended up becoming a big deal in Cairo, physician and so forth, a scholar. And I think a lot of people who know Egyptian history and Jewish history know about Maimonides, and they also know about the Jews in Egypt, Moses, of course. You know, you reference Moses,
yeah, sure,
as well.
Yeah.
How can you not? but you also, you were quoted as saying the vast majority of readers will be kind of shocked to hear that there were ever Jews in Cairo. And I wondered if you could just talk about the bigger idea of like where the fact that there is a long history of Jews in Egypt, and you know, maybe you struggle with that, maybe you didn't. How much to emphasize?
I struggle. I mean, it's at first when I set out to write the book, I was like, oh, I'm going to reckon with 1,000 years of Jewish history in Cairo. And I'm going to write, you know, 1,000-page book that's going to cover it all. And it's going to be like a chapter for each 100 years. And as soon as I started writing that, maybe I got like 6 months to a year in, and I was like, you know, I don't want to write this book. No one's going to want to read it. Like, this is not going to be a book that anyone is excited about. Although maybe it would have been, but it was also, you know, if this took me 7 years, imagine how long that would have taken me. So I really then had to sort of narrow my scope and be like, that's not my task. To write all about this long history. So I had to sort of be like, okay, what's the sort of long story that I'm trying to tell? And, you know, what are the key events in it? And as I wrote different iterations of the book, the sort of number of plot lines narrowed and narrowed and narrowed until it finally got to 3. I just think in terms of, you know, people not being aware of this history, I think that if anything, they're aware of, you know, the expulsion of the Jews, right, in the mid to late 50s, which is obviously an important part of the history. It's basically the end of that history. But the more I dug into it and the more I learned about this long history, the more I felt like, oh, this other story, the other, you know, 950, you know, 1,100 years really needs to be told. And the way I think about it is like, okay, Jews have been in the United States for 350 years. Imagine if, you know, God willing, the American experiment lasts another 700 years. I don't know, it doesn't seem too likely now, but who knows? You know, in 2718, you know, the Jews are expelled from the United States. And, you know, the people in the 29th century, all they want to talk about is, you know, 2718. Like, that to me would be such a tragedy if we just ignored, you know, 1,000 years of American Jewish history. Just to focus on this one moment, as important as it is, you know, that it's probably, you know, one of the top most important moments of Egyptian Jewish history, but also important to sort of look back on what happened before that, which was not all hunky-dory, I should say. You know, I'm not trying to imply that, you know, it was certainly, you know, a lot of despots, a lot of anti-Semitism, a lot of, you know, a lot of persecution. And as with any 1,000-year period, there were ups and downs.
Well, actually, and there you actually had your own ups and downs. And in fact, a reader, or excuse me, audience member asks about what is in your background allowed you to learn so much about the history of Cairo, and what is your personal experience? I know that you've talked about being in the back of a cab in Cairo and overhearing cab drivers saying, you know, the effing Jews and this and that, and how much you were willing to intervene and say, well, do you know you have a Jewish passenger? Mm-hmm. And I think in some cases you did, in some cases you didn't, right? So if you could talk about your own personal experience with reconciling with how far you go with saying, well, this isn't right. And on the other hand, you know, this may be, you know, I understand.
Yeah. I mean, that was a really hard thing for me, living in Cairo, also living in Tunis for a year after college, and to a lesser extent in Turkey after grad school. I think I didn't tell a lot of people I was Jewish when I was living in those parts of the Middle East. And I don't know if that was, you know, paranoia or excessive caution or what. I just, you know, didn't feel comfortable based on, you know, who knows what it was based on, you know, based on my own sort of bias, who knows. But the people I did tell, who I was, you know, close to, or, you know, those cab drivers that I sort of intervened on, the conversations that we had were incredibly fruitful. And I think the key thing that I took away is that, you know, there are these sort of stereotypical cartoonish anti-Semitic views of Jews in much of the Middle East. And I think that that has a lot to do with the fact that there just aren't that many Jews in most countries, you know? And so most of these people, the only time they hear the word Jew is, you know, Israeli soldiers on Al Jazeera or, you know, some classically anti-Semitic cartoon of, like, I don't know, George Soros or Henry Kissinger, who knows what it is in, like, in the newspapers. And without knowing an actual person, it's easy for those sort of stereotypes and that sort of hatred to just blossom. It was definitely a hard thing for me. The flip side is that, you know, I was in Tunis, right after 9/11, and what I felt was really balancing, you know, the kind of perspective of my cab drivers and, you know, random friends that I would meet on the street, which was sort of, you know, ignorant about America and particularly about Jews, with, you know, the perspective of my friends and family at home who were, you know, frankly, kind of ignorant about, you know, Arabs in the Middle East. And I just felt like I was sort of caught in between these two things. And, you know, that's obviously sort of something that I knew I was getting into going over there, but definitely felt and continue to feel like I'm balancing between those two. I think mostly it is. I mean, I say ignorance, not, I mean, it's a pejorative word, but it's, I think it just comes from most part from a lack of understanding, not, you know, any sort of core hatred.
A audience member talks about having read the book, so you have at least one fan, probably lots of fans here in the audience.
Or maybe they hated it. Yeah.
No, but he or she says, I was touched by the line, and the full line is on page 65. Ali had come to see himself as part of this community. This is the Watchman. Ali had come to see himself as part of this community. When you protect something, no matter what it is, it becomes your own. The question is, how does this play into the significant debate about cultural appropriation? There are lots of questions actually that one can ask about this. But I thought that was a beautiful line as well. Can you talk about that?
I was thinking about, like, what's the relationship between this young man who doesn't know anything really when he starts out about this community and the community that he's protecting. And he has a very sort of tender relationship to the Jewish community. And I was thinking, like, where's that come from? You know, and it comes from watching over something, you know. It's like, this is a weird metaphor, but I think about, like, my dog. Like, when I adopted him, if I had seen him on the street, I would have been like, who cares? You know, like, that dog can, who, you know, I don't know him from Adam. But as soon as I decided to, like, adopt him, I cared deeply about him from the moment that I decided that, even if he's peeing on the floor, which he does too much, more than he should, since we've had him for a long time. But anyways, you know, I really feel like, and it's the act of protection, I think, that does that. It's that sort of sense of responsibility. In terms of I see the sort of link to, you know, cultural appropriation or writing outside your experience. I definitely didn't intend that line, you know, to reflect on my own experience. But it's something with this book, I think it's a hard question because it's a book about coexistence, because it's a book that tells a lot of different stories from a lot of different points of view, you know, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, throughout time and space. It's hard to know, like, who owns the story, right? And I'm sure that you would be able to find someone who would sort of own it more than I do, you know, being someone who has an Ashkenazi background. But yeah, to me, that was something that I definitely wrestled with a lot. Like, what does it mean for me as an American Ashkenazi Jew to write about this community and to write about this place that I don't have a sort of familial connection to? And the answer that I came to is, you know, that it, you know, there are obviously some sort of leaps that I would say are beyond what I would sort of think makes sense to do and might even be sort of unsavory. But to me, I kept coming back to the question of like, well, whose story is this? And how can I tell it in a way that's sort of most sensitive? And when it comes down to it, you know, fiction is about telling stories outside yourself. If it's a story about yourself, then it's nonfiction. And so every piece of fiction is telling a story that's a little bit about outside yourself. And the question is, how far are you comfortable going? And how far does it make sense to go, given the sort of power and privilege that you hold? I have a friend who's a writer who is Sri Lankan, and she is she comes from a Buddhist family, and she talks about it in terms of like, you know, in Sri Lanka the Buddhists have sort of power and privilege, and so she's very careful to write about her Tamil characters in a way that is sensitive, and, you know, gives them a voice and et cetera, et cetera, you know. And then, cause when she comes back to the United States, you know, she experiences, you know, a lot of books that are sort of writing about, I don't know about Sri Lankan, but South Asian characters in a way that she finds sort of unsensitive and that don't pay attention to the power and privilege. So, you know, that's sort of, you know, we're all embodying lots of different identities. And I think that when we choose to write about someone outside, far outside ourselves, we have to sort of reflect on where we sit in relation to them, vis-a-vis power and history and things like that. And then once you decide you want to go for it, how can you write it in a way that's most sort of sensitive and true to that experience?
Right.
And that's the short answer.
Yeah. well, fiction can be, just like a lot of art forms, can be interpreted by people in a lot of different ways. I'm sure your books have. I once interviewed Naguib Mahfouz, the great Arab novelist in Cairo around 1990. And he was very much a secular author. But at the end of his life, he was attacked by religious zealots who found a lot of things wrong with his book. And I'm wondering if in your last book, and perhaps even in this one, which has been out since, I believe, March, whether you've had people who actually have been, if not offended by, but have taken issue with the characters in the book or something about the book. Have you gotten complaints?
I got complaints about my first book, but mostly about people didn't like the ending, including at one, like, Jewish book festival in Florida. I forget where. This woman, like, stood up and was like shaking her fist at me, like, how could you treat her like that? Talking about my main character. So that was semi-traumatic to me. But in terms of like the those types of more sort of identity-based questions, I haven't gotten criticized very much as far as I know. I mean, not in print at least. I will say that I am incredibly heartened and honored by the fact that like a lot of Egyptian reviewers and like bloggers have read the book and really appreciate it. There's this one book blogger who like mostly reads romance novels, and she somehow came upon the book, and just, you know, it was incredibly heartening to hear, you know, that she appreciated this depiction of her city and that she, you know, hadn't known much about the sort of Jewish history there. And so those, I always pay attention to the, they say don't read your reviews, but I always pay attention to those reviews that come from the country that I'm writing about. And it's really nice when they appreciate my depiction.
That's great. I'm going to remind our listening and internet audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. We're speaking with Michael David Lucas. Several people in the audience want an update of what's happening to the synagogue now. One question is, who watches the synagogue now? And another question is, could you discuss the Geniza at the synagogue and its present status? So is the synagogue still around?
Yeah, definitely. So it was reconstructed in the 80s or 90s by a sort of conglomerate of different forces, including the World Jewish Federation and Edgar Bronfman of Seagram's fame and fortune, and really beautifully reconstructed. And, you know, it's not a place of worship anymore. It's a tourist attraction. And so it's washed over by, the Egyptian tourism ministry, though I think that the Jewish community, like, technically has the keys to it. But in recent years, I think a lot of Arab countries, Egypt included, have seen the sort of potential for Jewish heritage travel that similar to what exists in, like, you know, Prague or Barcelona or Venice or something like that, and have reconstructed synagogues. So there's actually a couple synagogues in Cairo that have been reconstructed after the Ibn Ezra one, including, I think, the Maimonides Synagogue, is still in process, and it's been going on for a long time. But in Fez, I think, or Marrakesh, Morocco, just reconstructed a 16th or 15th century synagogue really beautifully. And, you know, at the end of the day, that all comes down to economics. I don't attribute that to anything but, you know, a desire for tourist dollars, which is sort of value neutral as far as I'm concerned. But I'm glad that, you know, you can go to the synagogues and see them and they look nice.
Yeah. I mean, one audience question is how many Jews are left in Egypt? And I think it might be fewer than 1,000?
Fewer than a dozen.
Fewer than a dozen. Okay.
Yeah. When I was there, it was maybe a few dozen in 2000. And most of the Jews who lived there then and now were very old. They were people who just sort of stuck around somehow by hook or by crook after the expulsion. There's now kind of this younger generation of people whose parents had either converted or were sort of underground, and then, you know, their parents told them recently, and so they may be sort of like raised Muslim but actually like a quarter Jewish, and sort of rediscovering that heritage. And there was one case of a pretty famous movie star, I forget his name now, coming out as Jewish. But, you know, he got a lot of pushback because of that from Egyptian society. And so, you know, there are very few Jews left. The biggest communities in the Middle East, as far as I know, are Turkey and Iran, both of which are sort of in the low thousands. And people, I always like to say, because people don't know, I actually don't know if this is still true, but it was true not too long ago. There is like a Jewish member of parliament in Iran. And so there still is. Okay. Good to know. So get my facts right. And it's a community that's, you know, definitely, sometimes under fire in a metaphorical sense. But, you know, it's relatively large in Iran. But in Egypt, very, very small.
Actually, I can tell from personal experience, I've been to Iran twice, and that I interviewed many members of the Jewish community there. Mm. There's a large Jewish community in Tehran, and there's a large Jewish community in Esfahan, which is the south of Iran. And Jews have lived in Iran for, you know, many, 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 many years.
Yeah.
But it is incredible to see them, see them in that context. One question for you is, you're the, I believe, the grandson of Holocaust survivors, right?
Yeah.
You consider yourself Jewish, but I don't know how religious, you know, practically speaking, you are. Mm. And I'm wondering if you, and a lot of the characters in the book are, they're devoutly religious.
Yeah.
And you write really nicely about the scroll and people's, when they inhabit these religious texts, how overcome they are, physically overcome. And I'm wondering if you, what your relationship is to that idea, whether you're overcome, even though you may not be as religious. You know, what's your experience with that?
I'm not particularly observant, but I am very strongly, you know, culturally identified. Otherwise, I wouldn't spend 15 years writing about Jews. I'm really, I think that my grandparents being Holocaust survivors gave me a very strong sense of sort of the long arc of Jewish history and the kind of uncertainty that might lurk around any corner, which until recently made me seem like a kind of paranoid crazy person. But now I think people are feeling that more recently. And the other thing it gave me is a really strong sense of, I guess, back of what a word like, you know, tikkun olam. I think some people take a kind of nationalist lesson from the Holocaust, and I take a more humanist lesson from the Holocaust. But in terms of my religiosity and the religiosity of the characters, there's observant Jews, Christians, Muslims. In part, it's the characters I'm dealing with, right? Agnes and Margaret are, you know, it would not be true to write them without sort of talking about their Presbyterianism and their sort of fundamentalist Presbyterianism, if that, I guess, it existed at the time. And they're just being on fire for, you know, the word of God, because that's what's driving them to do what they do. And in the same way, it's hard to write about the 11th century without talking about people who are, you know, religiously oriented. I see where that's coming from. It's not my sort of orientation, but I do feel a connection to that, and I think that allowed me to write that with maybe, or maybe it's why I chose the topic in the first place, because I wanted to explore that. But I'm not, you know, I'm not observant, as I said. I do celebrate some holidays, though. But then, but I also just wrote a piece that's coming out on Sunday that sort of, my title for it was Against Hanukkah. I don't know what they're gonna end up titling it. But it's kind of about, again, coming back to these same ideas, it's about Hanukkah being this kind of assimilationist Jewish Christmas version of Christmas. And, you know, for my daughter, it's like, you know, she's sad about not being able to have Santa, and so we give her, you know, some dreidels and some latkes, and to kind of tide her over. And so there's that dynamic going on, and that's what's driving our celebration of Hanukkah, and I think a lot of American Jews' celebration of Hanukkah. But at the same time, the history of the holiday is about basically, you know, a band of religious zealots who were in conflict with the assimilated Jews. And so we're celebrating these religious zealots who won out. Just that there's this deep contradiction at the heart of the holiday, and what do you do with that? And I'm not the first person to see it, you know, by any means. David Brooks wrote a column on it, I later realized after I finished the book. And the Talmudic rabbis, you know, they ask, what is Hanukkah? Like, what is this holiday all about? Why the heck are we celebrating this? You know, it's the only holiday that deals with a military victory, as far as I know. And the rabbis added in the miracle, basically, to sort of legitimize the holiday, you know, for lack of a better word. And so, you know, we're still celebrating it because what else are we going to do? You know, basically get a Christmas tree is the only other option. I'm not going to do that. So that's how I feel about Hanukkah.
Wow. For the record, that article will appear where?
In the Times Sunday Review section.
Okay, great. Well, somebody asked about writing an article for the New York Times on synagogues in Calcutta,
in
Egypt, and why you chose those particular examples.
That's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for that. I wrote an article about synagogues in Cairo, Tunis, and Calcutta, and just kind of my own obsession with visiting synagogues in different sort of non-Western places, for lack of a better term. And basically I chose those three because those were three places that I visited and had interesting experiences at the synagogues. But I am interested in general in sort of this long history and storied history of Jews outside Europe, and sort of talking about that history, even though it's not my heritage, because I think that it tells a sort of different and interesting story than the one that we often hear, which is about Ashkenazi Jews and the Holocaust. And that, you know, that story we often hear is my own heritage, but that doesn't mean, you know, I can't be interested in other stuff too. Yeah.
We're coming down to the last minute or so here. One audience member asks about your process of writing, how much you research, how many drafts you go through. I know you're beginning to teach writing in San Francisco State,
mm-hmm.
and there's often a question of whether you can really teach writing.
Mm.
Sort of like anything else, people are inherently writers, it seems. But how much can you really teach writing? And how much do you tell your students everything you've told us today here at the Commonwealth Club?
Well, I'm requiring them to listen to the podcast. So, no, I'm just kidding. I think that you cannot teach writing in that there's not a set of rules you can teach someone. It's not like biology or the law where, you know, you learn a set of rules or, you know, guidelines and then, you know, then you're good to go. I think you can teach writing in that you can guide someone towards texts that are interesting and guide them towards, you know, why different stories are working and why and how. And I think you can teach it in that you force people to write and share their writing and sort of build those muscles. And so I always come back to... although I'm not like the biggest fan of his writing, I do really like this quote of Ernest Hemingway, who said that we're all apprentices in a craft where no one ever becomes a master. And that basically is my mantra for teaching writing. You know, I'm just a fellow traveler, and I may have traveled along the path a bit longer or maybe not. And so I can be helpful insofar as I can help them sort of avoid the pitfalls along the way and show them some of the beautiful sights. But I don't think that there's like a set of rules that you can learn. Some people do. We just, you know, agree to disagree.
I think that's a good way to end it. We want to thank Michael David Lucas, author of The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. We also thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel, today's moderator. You've been listening to a Commonwealth Club program called The Last Watchman of Old Cairo. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.